FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You're listening to the Financial Survival Network. It's Carrie Lutz. The date is 11-11-15. Draw whatever inferences you want from it. So far, the world hasn't ended yet, but there are several technologies out there that are shaking things up for sure. And John Rubino, you wrote a great article about free energy and also about what's going on in the EU with Portugal. Is that any way to run a democracy? I don't think so. John, it's good to talk to you again. I was away for a bit.
Hey, Carrie. Yeah, good to talk to you too. Well, interesting news out of Texas just lately on the alt energy front. They've been slapping solar panels on basically everything down there and setting up windmills because they've got those plains where it goes on forever and the wind just blows. And so it's turning out that when set up that way in a hospitable place, solar and wind are actually extremely cheap. Right now, they've got wind power that's being given away by utilities because the wind tends to blow at night when people aren't using as much electricity, and they've got too much of it. So they're, as a marketing technique, they're giving it away. It's literally free on some nights. You can run all your appliances, throw a big party, and burn all the lights, and you don't have to pay a penny for power.
I have a great story about that. That's what you call time of day billing, because they'll give you the nights for free and then they will charge you a little bit more for the daytime hours, the peak hours. And the game is get you to switch your consumption patterns to the evening hours when there's less demand and the wind, they can't store the energy. So they basically just give it to you. And that's 10% of Texas's electrical generation coming from wind. So Con Edison, when I lived in New York, had this thing called time of day billing. And I said, this is great. I had a big house with like seven zones of AC, and it was costing a freaking fortune. So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get on this time of day billing where at night after 9 o'clock, it was 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. During peak time, the rest of the day, it was 15.5 cents. So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get this house freezing between 9 and 6 when it switched back. I'm going to get the house 5 degrees colder than it normally would be. And I'm going to save a fortune because all my cooling, what I found was that if I got it down to 66 degrees, the house, that it didn't heat up again till 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. All right. It stayed cold. And I did this for like a couple of weeks and I'm so happy I'm saving money, John. And my kids and my wife had a total rebellion. We're freezing. You can't do this to us. Blah, blah, blah. This is terrible. You know, and that was the end of my experiment with time of day billing. So, but
yeah,
this really is free, but free because you have the electrical subsidy.
Yeah. Yeah. Right now, solar and wind aren't as cheap as they seem in terms of the headlines about them right now because they're subsidized. But the prices are plunging. So if they have another decade like the previous decade, they won't need subsidies at all. They will be by far the cheapest sources of electricity out there, at least in sunny, windy places like Texas. And that's a revolution. You know, with wind being abundant at night, you've also got solar being very abundant in the daytime. So you combine these two intermittent sources and you've got really cheap power across the clock. And as they keep getting cheaper, while fossil fuels bounce around, you know, they're a little cheaper lately than they have been in the recent past. But over time, they kind of bounce within a range. They aren't over a long period of time getting cheaper. So you're going to see these lines cross. And solar and wind are going to dominate the energy market at some point out there. And the question is, what's the timing? Does it happen right away because solar and wind keep getting cheaper at the 5 or 10% a year rate that they have been in the past? Or does it take a little longer? And where do electric cars come in all of this? You know, that's anybody who's driven an electric car knows they are really fun to drive. I've only driven a Nissan Leaf, which is kind of a lower end electric car. It's not a Tesla. But even that had my wife saying, oh, I want one of these. You know, can we get one right now? Can we just because it was just a blast to drive. And when they're widely available and economic, I think you'll see huge demand for them, too. So there are a lot of pieces to the alternative energy puzzle that have various kinds of timing, and it's not clear how they all come together. But I think you can safely say that 30 or 40 years from now, fossil fuels will have been relegated to a really minor part of the global energy infrastructure, and renewable sources will be the dominant forms of power generation.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the trend is the trend, and a trend in motion stays in motion until it's stopped. And it's a question of economics. I mean, my brother-in-law in Arizona has got a whole solar cell setup, but the government paid like a third of the cost of the installation, but he's saving like 30, 40 bucks a month and selling power back to the power company. They don't like that at all.
That's another part of the story is utilities are pushing back because they're threatened by this. You know, if you down there in Florida put solar panels on your roof and then batteries in your basement, you charge the batteries during the daytime, you run them at night.
We don't have basements.
You hardly need the grid at all.
Yeah. We don't have
basements. Oh, wait, that's right. You don't have
Everything's on a slab here, but I know what you're saying.
In your fourth spare bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fill it full of batteries. Mm-hmm. And you end up not needing to be on the grid at all. And that means utilities have all these fixed costs that they've got to cover with fewer and fewer customers. And it's existentially disastrous for them. You know, it's a life-threatening situation. Yeah. So they're pushing back. But I think everybody works it out in the end. You know, there are deals that can be cut that make it possible for solar and wind to be attractive to people.
Yeah.
And also attractive to the existing electric utilities, so that, you know, it'll happen. These guys will accommodate each other, and we'll see the new technology spread to the extent that their costs make it worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, it's got to happen. And I'm not just talking about oil scarcity. I don't believe we're really going to run out of oil. It will get more expensive because as it gets harder to obtain. Right now, what we're having is an anomalous situation, but we're going to see the supply picture tighten in the future. So, hey, if we can the fact is electrical generation consumes very little oil, not used for oil. Oil's just not used for electrical generation in very many places left in the U.S., other than some plants that are in place that haven't been converted to natural gas, older plants that can't be or it's not economically feasible, and certain peaker plants, as they call them, where when consumption really hits high levels, then you put on the peaker plants and they generate electricity and take some of the burden off the grid. So once you get past that, it just has to happen. There's really, really little choice. Pollution-wise, I think it will be a net plus in the long run, but it's pretty exciting to be living through these times where we switch to a new energy source and you see it happening. You recognize the trend before it happened. Not that you can necessarily make any money off of this.
Well, yeah, that's the problem with really high growth industries. Is the industry itself is doing great. It's spreading and everything, but the suppliers of the product, whatever it is, tend to be in a really competitive market where everybody's prices are falling and it's hard to tell who the winners and losers are going to be ahead of time and accept that there will be more losers than winners. So, you know, you could have lost your shirt by buying the early computer makers, for instance. And the microchip companies are always, you know, heading into some kind of a supply glut that sends their prices way down, even though the industry itself is growing like crazy. Solar is similar to that. It's got a lot of players with a lot of new technologies coming along. Everybody's seeing higher sales, but a lot of the biggest players are not seeing higher profits. So it's hard to make money in this kind of an industry as an investor, but it's a lot of fun to watch from a safe distance. You know, this is fascinating. And we've seen some revolutions lately that have ended up going a lot more quickly than looked reasonable at the beginning. You know, when digital cameras first came along, they looked kind of like a novelty. And 20 years later, they own the market and smartphones. And, you know, in the mid-2000s, they were a rich guy's toy. And now everybody has one. And the old kinds of phones are going extinct. So it's conceivable that the same thing will happen with alternative energy and fossil fuels, where the transition will be a lot faster than seems likely right now. And that would be fun, you know, unless you're an oil company. It's a really interesting prospect.
Hey, and just to talk about smartphones, one of the guys that I hang out with at Starbucks in the morning, like, he is a technical Luddite. I mean, he's just fought it and fought it and fought it. So I knew, John, that smartphones had become mainstream when he got one. I mean, he might have gotten it. It might be a Metro One smartphone. That has, like, you know, like, no capacity to do anything. But once he got it, I said, okay, these things are mainstream. He is the ultimate holdout. And that's that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And see, now he will become a convert. You know, he'll play with his new phone and then he'll want to step right up to the newest Apple next time around.
Exactly. I believe you're correct. So all this is good. It all bodes well for all of us here. And I think combine these things with smartphones, able to control these things remotely. It's a great thing. But in the meantime, we have to get through what's happening to us in the world here. Just like you mentioned in your article, the sales of cars were booming during the Great Depression. There was still a Great Depression going on. Look what's going on in Portugal. Just why don't you tell us, John, because you need a scorecard to tell the players.
Yeah. It's a fascinating time. And Portugal is a really interesting story, among many interesting stories out there. But they just recently had an election where they gave a majority to a coalition of left-wing parties. They're anti-austerity, in some cases anti-NATO, and they want to nationalize a lot of the major industries. And they've got a parliamentary majority now. So it looks like they're going to get to form a government after a lot of wrangling. And it looks like that government will not go along with the austerity measures that the European Union, that the Eurozone, has imposed on the peripheral countries. So basically, it's Greece all over again, only on a bigger scale.
Yeah, much bigger. I mean, Portugal is not a huge economy, but it's several times the size of Greece and a more, I guess you would say, productive economy than Greece.
Well, yeah, it's not in crisis the way Greece is. I mean, its numbers are still pretty scary. Unemployment is high and growth is slow, but it's not in a Great Depression. Capital D depression, the way Greece is. But there also isn't anything on the horizon to pull them out of the recession that they're in because, you know, they don't control their currency. They can't devalue the euro unilaterally. And so the only other way to get out from under the debts that are still accumulating there, you know, their debt to GDP ratio continues to go up, is to cut their internal costs to the point where their labor is cheap enough that they can export stuff cheaply enough to generate growth. And that means that the whole adjustment comes on the back of working people. And hence the last election. You know, if you tell people that they're going to get a 30% pay cut in order to fix the government's finances, they're going to be more likely to change the government than to go along with a 30% pay cut. And that's what happened. And so now what the new government probably wants to do is to dramatically increase government spending, run a bigger deficit, use that money to jumpstart the economy through public works spending, and grow in that way. Of course, that's in the long run, that's also a disaster because you increase the amount of government debt to the point where the government can't function with normal interest rates. And it then has to push its internal interest rates down to negative numbers, which distorts the market to the point where capitalism doesn't work anymore because the pricing signals coming from interest rates and other markets don't send correct information anymore. So you don't know how to allocate capital. So blah, blah, blah. You know, we've talked about this a few times, Kerry, and exactly. It's just playing out now in a new place. But it's about to play out everywhere because the only real solution for a country like Portugal is for the euro itself to be devalued really dramatically. And I think the Europeans are gradually coming to this conclusion that they have to go currency war big time here. You know, they've got to cut the value of the euro by some really large percentage, more than it has been. It's down by about 20%, or maybe 30% now after the dollar has spiked just lately versus the dollar. But that hasn't been enough. Europe isn't growing. Its inflation is flat. And the peripheral countries are starting to elect left-wing governments that aren't going to go along with the dominant theme of European economic policy any longer. And so, you know, the same thing happened in Spain just now, where a region accounting for one-fifth of Spain's GDP voted to secede and wants to become its own country. And you're going to see more and more of that as time goes on because it's not working now. You know, the system is set up to keep the bankers fat and happy and at the expense of regular working people and with the bank bail-ins that they've all got planned now for the next banking crisis, small depositors in banks. So the fact that it can't go on means that it won't go on. We'll see either a change from the top in economic policy, much, much more aggressive QE, for instance, and negative interest rates and an attempt to devalue the euro, or we'll see it bubble up from below, where every election is a throw the bums out event and installs somebody who's hostile to the dominant policies coming out of Brussels. And that's basically it. Those are the only two scenarios that make any sense for Europe right now. So I think they'll take the path of least resistance, as governments always do, and aggressively try to devalue the euro in the year ahead. Yeah. Which means the U.S., if we intend to raise interest rates, we're playing into their hands. You know, that'll make the dollar even stronger, and that will, you know, unilaterally devalue the euro, at least versus the dollar. So we'll be helping them out, but it'll come at the expense of our export industries and our regular working people. And so it can't last long here either.
Yeah, no, it can't. I don't see how it could. Think about it. It's not a recipe for success. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really isn't. Yeah. Well, and it's because we borrowed too much money. If you borrow too much money, you're only left with choices like this.
Yeah.
And historically, the kinds of mistakes the whole developed world has made lately, historically, those mistakes have been made by individual countries who then just devalued their currencies. You know, when Argentina makes its periodic financial mistakes and they just lop three zeros off the peso and life goes on. Well, we got the whole world in that same boat right now. And so it's not easy to see a solution that that is palatable to everybody when the whole developed world and a big part of the developing world are overleveraged. You know, what do you do? And Jim Rickards, whose analysis I really like, says that eventually we'll figure out that the only thing we can devalue against all of us at once is gold. And so we'll have a mass devaluation and a return to some form of the gold standard. And so we'll have this burst of inflation when, you know, milk that used to cost $3 a gallon costs $9 a gallon. And gasoline and rent and everything goes up. But it goes up and then it stops going up because we now have a sound currency that is once again linked to a real commodity like gold. And that doesn't sound like fun for most people. You know, if you are holding dollars when that happens, you lose half or a third or whatever of your nest egg.
It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, but it would leave us with a sustainable system going forward. So, you know, we don't have any pain-free options, but this might be the least painful option. And it also leaves us with gold worth $5,000 or $10,000 an ounce, which is fine for gold bugs. You know, that's the most attractive scenario for somebody who's been stacking.
I'll take it. Yeah. $10,000 an ounce, I'll take. $10,000, that would make it worth 10 times more than it is now, purchasing power gets cut by a third, 50%, two thirds, but your value of your precious metal holdings goes up 10 times. I think that's a great outcome, but I mean, it's going to be so much pain for the world. You're not going to be happy even no matter how much.
And then you don't know what governments will do about all this too, you know, whether they impose a windfall profits tax on precious metal sales or, or some kind of wealth confiscation or, you know, there are a lot of things they can do to kind of equalize the burden. So it's not clear that just owning a bunch of gold in that kind of scenario, it leads you free and clear and rich. Because it's, it's completely possible that there's public policy stuff going on that, that disadvantage you and, you know, punish you for making the right decision. And that, that'd be kind of par for the course, wouldn't it, for the last 20 or 30 years?
Absolutely.
Where somebody who presumably made the right decision by saving a lot and investing conservatively in you know, holding a lot of cash in a bank account or whatever, is now being punished by government policy. Yeah. So the next stage of that might be that the people who made the right decision going forward by loading up on real things like gold and silver will be punished in some way. So who knows?
Oh,
there's really no way to know.
Oh, it totally won't surprise me if that's the final scenario. Rewarding bad behavior. Government has been doing that with alarming regularity for quite some time. It's getting worse. We'll get worse before it gets better. This you can be certain. Anyway, find John's work at dollarcollapse.com. Link is always found in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Take a look at the site while you're there. Our webmaster, Stefan, works for hours every day, finding you articles like John's, explaining what's going on here and what you need to do to be prepared for the inevitable. John, we will talk with you next week.
Thanks, Gary. Talk to you then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.